Good evening, everybody. If you will, open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 12. That's where we're going to be for most of our lesson tonight, 1 Kings chapter 12. And I want to begin my sermon tonight with a chart. I think Scott will like this. You might remember that in 1 Samuel chapter 8, in the days of Samuel, the people came to Samuel and requested a king. And what they said in verse 5 was, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." They wanted a king to rule them like the other nations had a king. And God would go on to tell them, this is the procedure for you when you do appoint a king for you. There are some warnings, there are some instructions there. And so I found a chart, ran across this chart, which helps illustrate the difference between the kings that the nations had and the kings that Israel would have, ideally have. And I think this helps us keep in perspective kind of the story of the kings as we look from king to king and learn some lessons. This helps us see kind of the broader picture of how they ended up. One of the big differences was how they were appointed and who they were appointed by. Of course, the nation's kings were appointed by the nations, by people, humans. But by and large, the Israelite nations were appointed by God. You might remember that Saul was appointed directly by God. God told Samuel, "You go find Saul." And not only that, when Saul became a failure, God told Samuel to go find David. And of course, it was through David that Solomon came and then Rehoboam. And after that, as we're going to see tonight, it was God who appointed Jeroboam to be the king who would split the kingdom. And so these kings over Israel were appointed ultimately by God. Another difference was the realm in which they exercised authority and what kind of authority they exercised. The nation's kings didn't answer to anybody. They had sovereign authority. They could do whatever they pleased. But the kings over Israel, ideally, were subject to God. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, when Moses is instructing the people about how to appoint a king whenever, because God knew that this was going to happen, and Moses instructed them in Deuteronomy 17, verse 18, "Now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandments to the right or to the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel." I love the imagery that's portrayed here, that when a king was appointed, whenever he came to the throne, the first thing that he was to do is he was to sit down in the Levitical priesthood's presence and write a copy for himself, the law of God. And that served a couple of purposes. First of all, it was to remind him that he was subject to God. As Moses points out, that his heart may not be lifted above his countrymen, that he was no different than his people who was ruling, that he was just as subject to God as they were. But secondly, that as a king subject to God, that he himself would rule in a way consistent with God's commandments. And so the kings over Israel were to be subject to God. A third difference is their religious role. And when you study some of the history of the Canaanite kings and even the Egyptian kings and Babylonian kings, they served in a very religious role. They, a lot of times, were the religious leaders. They gave the religious law. They served as priests. And many times, they were even perceived as being divine, or at least semi-divine. They were worshipped as God, or maybe being kind of a halfway point between man and God. So they were definitely a religious figure. But when it comes to Israelite leaders, they didn't serve in any religious role at all. Their role was separate and apart from the role of the priests. And later on in Israelite history, and in Judah's history, there was a king named Uzzah, who decided, or excuse me, Uzziah, who took it upon himself to go into the temple and offer incense. And as soon as he did that, the priests saw and they ushered him out. And he became arrogant and his heart was proud and leprosy broke out on his forehead because that was not his role. Now, as we're going to see in a moment, his role was to enforce God's law, but he was not a religious leader per se. And so he needed to keep that in perspective. And ultimately, his primary function in the nations, his primary function was to increase the kingdom by conquering and capturing more territory and increasing in military might. That was really the function of a pagan king. But an Israelite king, his primary function was to rule justly and promote God's ways. He didn't make the laws of God. In fact, he didn't make any laws to begin with, because every law had already been written. Remember, this was a theocracy, meaning that this was God's kingdom, not the king's kingdom. And so I point this chart out to you because whenever we look at the king's history, most of the kings we're going to study in this series, and most of the kings in Israelite history, rejected their proper God-given role. And instead of understanding their role as being subject to God and just being God's representative to enforce God's ways, instead they acted like the nation's kings. And that's exactly what the people wanted, wasn't it? They asked for a king to rule them like the nations. In fact, one of the things that they said in that chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 8, we want a king who will lead us into battle, who will fight our battles for us. They wanted a king like the nations. And by all means, that's what they got. And sad to say, that led them to destruction. They rejected God's wisdom, just like the kings rejected God's wisdom. So tonight we're going to be looking at one of the saddest points in Israel's history. And this is when the kingdom divides. And I think this is a very important time in Israel's history for us to understand. If we don't understand how the kingdom divided, then a lot of what the rest of the Bible history, Old Testament history, has to say, like in the prophets and the rest of the kings, we're not going to understand it fully. So I think this is an important time for us to consider. We're going to be considering, first of all, how the kingdom divided. Secondly, why the kingdom divided. And then we're going to evaluate the decisions that were made. And we're going to do something a little different tonight. Most of our lessons so far have been just focused on one king and some lessons on them. But tonight we're going to be looking at the two kings that were involved, Rehoboam and Jeroboam, and some lessons, some applications that we can make from them. But first of all, let's think about how the division took place. How the division took place. So you might remember that Solomon started out as a great king. He loved God. But then his wives turned his heart away. And as a consequence to Solomon's downfall, God said that one of the consequences was the kingdom was going to be torn away from his son. And in 1 Kings chapter 11, it is Jeroboam who is chosen to strip the kingdom away from Solomon's son. So I want you to notice a few things here in 1 Kings chapter 11, beginning in verse 28. Now the man Jeroboam was a valiant warrior. And when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he appointed him over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. Now that's an interesting point, because in chapter 12, as we're going to see, it was the forced labor that the people complained about. They complained about the heavy burden upon them, and they appointed Jeroboam to be leader over them. And it was Jeroboam who was appointed under Solomon to be one of those leaders who would kind of oversee the forced labor. So keep that in mind. And in verse 29, it came about at that time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, that the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him on the road. Now Ahijah had clothed himself with a new cloak, and both of them were alone in the field. Then Ahijah took hold of the new cloak which was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, "Take for yourself 10 pieces. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. But he will have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel." So Ahijah chooses Jeroboam by God's will to be the king who would tear the kingdom out of Solomon's son. And in verse 38, God gives him a promise, a conditional promise. It says, "Then it will be that if you listen to all that I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my sight by observing my statutes and my commandments, as my servant David did, then I will be with you and build you an enduring house as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you." So he gave Jeroboam a great promise. Look, if you listen to my words, and if you rule faithfully like David did, then I'm going to build you an enduring house. Well, verse 40 tells us what Solomon thought about this. "Solomon sought, therefore, to put Jeroboam to death. But Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt, to Shishak, king of Egypt, and he was in Egypt until the death of Solomon." And so Solomon, instead of recognizing that this was simply the consequence of his choices to turn away from God, instead he tried to kill Jeroboam, and so Jeroboam runs away. We come to chapter 12 now. And Solomon has died, and Rehoboam naturally has ascended to the throne in his place. And in verse 1, "Then Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king." And it appears to me that at the end of chapter 11, it's the southern part of the nation that's still a unified nation. Judah is recognizing that he is still ruled, that he is the appropriate ruler. But in chapter 12 and verse 1, he has to go up to Shechem, away from his capital, north into the territory of Israel, for the people of Israel to recognize that he is king. And in verse 2, "When Jeroboam the son of Nebat heard it, he was living in Egypt, for he was yet in Egypt, where he had fled from the presence of King Solomon. Then they sent and called him, and Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, 'Your father made our yoke hard, and now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you.'" Now, as Danny read for us, Rehoboam consults the elders, and the elders tell him, "Look, if you listen to the people and you lighten their load, then they're going to be loyal to you. They're going to submit to you because they're going to recognize you are using your authority for their good." But then he rejected the elders' advice, and he went to his companions, the people he grew up with, his friends. And they said to him, "Boy, make their yoke harder." And so that's exactly what he does. And so then the kingdom divides. The northern 10 tribes break away and they appoint Jeroboam to be their king. So in verse 16, "When all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, 'What portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now look after your own house, David.' So Israel departed to their tents. But as for the sons of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. Then the king Rehoboam set Adoram, who was over the forced labor, and all Israel stoned him to death." So he's trying to make amends here. He's trying to pull the people back to him. So he sends the slave labor master, and they just kill him. And so King Rehoboam makes haste to mount his chariot and flees to Jerusalem. So verse 19 concludes, "So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day." So this is how the kingdom split. There are three reasons that kind of go into the background here, the reasons for the division. And I want you to understand as we go through these reasons that this was a long time coming. This was just kind of inevitable for this to happen because of the seeds that had been planted by Solomon and some of the other kings, and even going back even further into their history. This was inevitable. The first reason, what we just talked about, is the heavy taxation. And under Solomon's reign, the nation, the kingdom, was extraordinarily wealthy, extraordinarily prominent and influential. As we noticed last week, silver was as common as stones. It wasn't even considered valuable. Solomon drank out of a gold goblet. The people, even themselves, the commoners, were wealthy and they enjoyed the peace and prosperity. But all of that prosperity came with a high price. It came through taxation. And really, this fulfilled what Samuel said back in 1 Samuel chapter 8. This is one of the warnings that God gave Israel about asking for a king. Look, if you ask for a king, understand this is what they're going to do to you. In verse 11, Samuel said, This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He'll take your sons and place them for chariots and for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and reap his harvest and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officials and his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. And then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. God's trying to make a point to the people. You don't quite understand what you're asking for. You're asking for a king to lead you in a physical way. He's going to rule over you, but he's also going to tax you to death. He's going to take your sons and your daughters and make them slaves. He's going to take your vineyards and your fields, and it's going to be a heavy burden upon you. And this was coming to fruition. God had warned them in the beginning that this was going to happen, and now they're paying the price. But a second factor was their history. The Israelites really had never really gotten along. There was a long history of strife and jealousy between them, even when the children of Israel were first born. Remember, way back in the book of Genesis, when Jacob's wives, Rachel and Leah, they were having the children of Israel, the tribes that would the men that would come, the tribes from which they would come. They were born out of competition. Remember, they were trying to one up one another. Rachel would have a son, and then Leah would have a son, and they would just try to compete with one another. And this kind of affected the way they treated one another. That's why Joseph was sold into slavery. That's why later on in the time of Judges, there's so much fighting and strife between the nations. And it even goes back to the days of David, where in 2 Samuel chapter 20, there's a rebellion against David and his kingdom. 2 Samuel chapter 20, and I want you to notice an explicit connection between this rebellion and the split in Rehoboam's day. In verse 1 of 2 Samuel chapter 20, it says, "Now a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite. And he blew the trumpet and said, 'We have no portion in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel.'" Now, do those words sound familiar? Those are the words that the Israelites used against Rehoboam. "We have no portion in David, nor do we have an inheritance in the son of Jesse, every man to his tents." And so the kingdom splits really kind of after a pattern in Sheba's rebellion. They write their declaration of independence, as it were, following his example. And then thirdly, there's the prophecy that God had made through Ahijah the prophet. And in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 15, the writer points out that the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of events from the Lord, that he might establish his word, which the Lord spoke through Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Interestingly, you see the hand of God in history here, that this was a turn of events from the Lord that he would fulfill his word. And so this was the prophecy being fulfilled against Solomon's idolatry and his choice to turn away from God. This is why the kingdom split. But let's look at the mistakes that were made. The two kings that were involved here, Rehoboam, Solomon's son, who takes the southern kingdom, and then Jeroboam, who later takes the northern kingdom. It's interesting that they both make three similar mistakes that we need to learn from. First of all, and maybe most importantly, they heeded and listened to the wrong kind of advice. They sought the wrong kind of advice. In 1 Kings chapter 12, there's one word that appears two times in this chapter. The same word. In verse 6, it says, "King Rehoboam consulted with the elders." And in 1 Kings chapter 12 in verse 28, it says, the king, Jeroboam, consulted. That word is the same word in the Hebrew. The kings consulted. And that was the problem. They sought the wrong kind of advice from the wrong kind of people. In Rehoboam's case, the problem was that he listened to his peers instead of listening to those who were older. Now, those who were older were probably the elders of the tribes, maybe 12 of them, each who represented the tribes themselves, and they appealed to Rehoboam, listen, look, the taxation is too heavy for us. We can't continue living this way. This is such a big burden upon us. And wisely, the elders who ruled in the days or advised Solomon in his days, they said, look, listen to the people, and they will therefore listen to you. But he forsook the counsel in verse 8 of the elders when they had given, and they consulted with the young men who grew up with him and served him. Now, let me ask you a question. Why did he consult the young men instead of listening to those who were older? It could be because of the generation gap. It could be because the older advice just wasn't making much sense to him. Or it could have just been the connection that he had with the younger people. The point is that he didn't have the wisdom that his father Solomon had. His father Solomon wouldn't have made a choice like this because he had the justice and he had the wisdom to rule righteously. But he sought the wrong kind of advice. And he failed to realize that authority exercised with self-sacrifice brings true loyalty. And I think that's a lesson for anyone who is in a position of authority. That if we want to truly be good leaders, and we want to lead the people in a way that they will follow us, sometimes we need to listen to the people that we are leading. But Jeroboam made a similar mistake. Later on in the chapter in verse 28, it says, so the king consulted. Now, the text does not tell us who he consulted. But the idea is the same. He consulted somebody. Maybe he consulted the elders who advised Solomon. We don't know that for sure. Maybe he consulted some of his friends or some of his cabinet, some of his advisors. But what they said is essentially, make the two golden calves. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But they led him away from God. He consulted the wrong advice. Why did he not consult God? He was trying to figure out, what am I going to do with the kingdom here? The people are going to go back to Rehoboam because that's where Jerusalem is. That's where the temple is. So how am I going to preserve my kingdom here? And he does not think to seek God's counsel. And here's the lesson for us. We need to make sure that not only do we seek advice, but we seek the right kind of advice. The book of Proverbs has a lot to say about advice and whether or not we listen to it, but it also has something to say about listening to the right kind of advice. We might think, well, I'm being wise and just asking somebody what they think, but that's not enough. We have to ask ourselves, who should I ask? Who is the right person to ask? And what kind of advice are they giving me? Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 20 says, listen to counsel and accept discipline, that you may be wise the rest of your days. The point is that sometimes good counsel is not what we want to hear. Sometimes good counsel comes from discipline, and it comes with discipline, and sometimes it's painful. And the question is, are we going to be humble enough and wise enough, as Proverbs points out, to listen to that kind of counsel? It's not enough just to listen to what our friends say. But ultimately, we need to ask ourselves, what kind of advice am I seeking? And advice comes in a lot of different forms today. It comes through counselors. It comes through books. It comes through our congregation. It comes through our family. And again, it's not enough just to ask for advice. We need to consider, what is that advice compared to God's Word? Is that the kind of advice that is ultimately going to help me spiritually? That was the first mistake that the two kings made. The second mistake is that they only thought of themselves. They only thought of themselves, and that's really what made their decisions. Again, in Rehoboam's case, it was a matter of pride. Why do you think that he wanted to listen to the younger people's advice when they said to him, look, just make the people's burden harder? And they didn't just say that, but they said it in a metaphorical way. They said to Rehoboam, tell the people, Solomon is, it was a, you know, a great king, but as they say, your father made our yoke heavy, but my little finger is thicker than my father's loins. And that was the way they kind of snubbed their nose at the people. And that appealed to Rehoboam's pride. Boy, if I treat the people like that, they're going to really understand who's boss here. They're going to understand who's in charge. And he did not listen to true wisdom because they just appealed to his pride. They appealed to a sense of power. And in similar case, Jeroboam listened to counsel. And in this case, he listened to the fear that was motivating him. Read with me 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 26 and 27. Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And listen to this, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. The people will return there and they will kill me. He makes a wrong choice out of fear. He's afraid for his life. He wants to preserve his kingdom, but more than that, he wants to preserve himself. And so ultimately, he creates a new system of religion. And again, there's a lesson for us. When we only think of self, it's going to sever our relationships. Yes, it's going to sever our physical relationships with our friends and our family. We make selfish choices. We treat people thinking only of what's good for me instead of thinking about serving them. But ultimately, it's going to sever our relationship with God, as it did with Jeroboam. The Bible, the New Testament, encourages us to not do anything out of selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. And I think especially in the case of Rehoboam, if he had only considered that fact, that what this people needs is greater than my power and my pride, then he would not have split the kingdom. But of course, this was ultimately from God's will. So only thinking of self creates divisions. But then finally, the third mistake that they made was they did evil in God's eyes with lasting consequences. This is really what it boiled down to. They each did evil in the eyes of God. In the case of Rehoboam, he led the people, the southern kingdom, into further idolatry. He followed after his father. And not only did he follow after his father, but he did more than his father Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 14, in verse 22, it says, Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy more than all their fathers had done with the sins which they committed. For they also built for themselves high places and sacred pillars and Asherim on every high hill and beneath every luxuriant tree. There were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. Notice again that the people in 1 Samuel chapter 8, they wanted a king like the nations. And here they're getting a king like the nations. He's leading them to be like the people that they were told to drive out in following after idols and immorality. That was where Rehoboam went wrong. But then Jeroboam made the same mistake. He went a different direction. Instead of following after the Asherim and the Canaanite idols, instead he just built his own idols. And so in 1 Kings chapter 12, in verse 28, it says, so the king consulted and made two golden calves. And he said to them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you out from the land of Egypt. Now let's pause right there and contemplate this statement. Think about Israel's history and ask yourself, does that sound familiar? Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. Where have we heard that before? When the people came out of Egypt and they were at the foot of Mount Sinai, and Moses went up on the mountain to receive the law, the people said, "Where's Moses?" And so they said, "We need a God. We don't know what happened to Moses." And so Aaron says, "Well, bring me your gold." And so he fashions it into a golden calf, and he says the same exact thing. "Behold your God that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Have they not understood from their history that this is going to only lead them to destruction? Have they not learned from their previous mistakes in history? But yet they're doing the same thing. So in verse 29, Jeroboam set one in Dan, or in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. And these are the two extremities of the northern kingdom. Dan is in the northern extremity, Bethel's in the southern extremity. And here's an interesting tidbit. Bethel is only about 11 miles from Jerusalem, which really isn't that far. But yet Jeroboam was thinking to himself, "Boy, I don't want them to all go all the way down to Jerusalem. And so I'll just set up this convenient system at Bethel for them to worship." If they only went 11 miles more, they would have worshiped God. But yet he was only focused on himself and what was convenient for himself and for the people. So he built the high places in verse 31. And made priests from among all the people who were not of the sons of Levi. And in verse 32, Jeroboam instituted a feast in the eighth month on the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah. And he went up to the altar, thus he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves which he had made. And he stationed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. And the emphasis in this passage is on what Jeroboam did and what he did in his own heart. The feast that he comes up with, he patterns it after the Feast of Tabernacles. He just changes it to the next month. Instead of the seventh month, he changes it to the eighth month. And so this is him turning away from God instead of listening to God and his commandments. Remember, Jeroboam had been given a promise. "If you will follow my commandments, then I will establish you as a king." But here he's showing himself to be unworthy of that promise. And there are a couple serious consequences that came from Jeroboam's choice here. First of all, Jeroboam set a pattern, a precedent, for every single Israelite king who would come after him. Almost every single king who came after Jeroboam, who led the northern kingdom, it is said of them that they followed Jeroboam's footsteps. For example, in 1 Kings chapter 15 and verse 34... it says of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, "He did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he made Israel sin." Almost every single Israelite king of the northern kingdom, it is said that of them. He walked in Jeroboam's ways. The point that I'm making from that is that Jeroboam set a pattern, a precedent, from which Israel would never, ever recover. And there's a point of application for us. When we consider the influence we have, of course, we don't have the kind of influence that Jeroboam or Rehoboam had as kings, but we've got an influence over other people to some extent, over our children, over our spouses, over our brethren in Christ, over the people we work with. We've got an influence, and the question is, what kind of influence are we having over them? Are we setting a pattern or precedent that will lead them astray? Are paving the way for them to do that which is right. And ultimately, this led the northern kingdom into exile. In fact, before Jeroboam even leaves office, in 1 Kings chapter 14, the exile is already in view. 1 Kings chapter 14 and verse 15, it says, "For the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. And he will uproot Israel from this good land which he gave to their fathers and will scatter them beyond the Euphrates River because they have made their Asherim, provoking the Lord to anger. He will give up Israel on account of the sins of Jeroboam, which he committed and with which he made Israel to sin." Jeroboam made Israel sin. And those of us who serve in positions of leadership need to take that to heart. What are we doing with our leadership? And what are we doing with our influence? And so what kind of legacy are we going to leave behind? Are we going to leave behind the legacy of Jeroboam? Are we going to leave behind the legacy of Rehoboam? Or are we going to point people ultimately to God? But let's close tonight by looking forward. We did this last week when we closed our lesson on Solomon. And I think it's important when we study Old Testament history to look at Old Testament history from the big picture. We've got the benefit of the New Testament and Jesus' perspective. He shows us all of the things that are the Old Testament in its history pointed us to Jesus. So how does this fit into God's plan to save man through Jesus Christ? Well, if we go 350 years later to the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel promises that one day the two parts of the kingdom will be reunited. In Ezekiel chapter 37, we're not going to read all of these verses, but I want you to notice in verse 15 beginning, "The word of the Lord came again to me saying, 'And you, son of man, take for yourself one stick and write on it for Judah and the sons of Israel and his companions. Then take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel and his companions. Then join them for yourself one to another into one stick that they may become one in your hand.'" Here's an object lesson for the people. He was to take two sticks, write on one Judah, write on one Israel, and bring them together. Tape them, tie them together. And in verse 18, "When the sons of your people speak to you, saying, 'What will you not declare to us what these things mean?' And say to them, 'Thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will put them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand.'" And then dropping down to verse 24, it says, "My servant David will be king over them." There's one king here. There aren't two kings. There's not Jeroboam and Rehoboam, but there's one king ruling one people. And the point that Ezekiel and God are making here is that one day there will be one nation living in one land, serving one God, under one law and one covenant, in one temple, and led by one single king. There will not be any division. And who is this king? Well, it's not David, because David has been long dead, but we know who it is, that this king is ultimately Jesus Christ. It says, "David will be king over them, and they will have one shepherd," verse 24, "and they will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them." And then in verse 27, "My dwelling place also will be with them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people." And all of that is ultimately fulfilled in the one king that would come, the perfect king, the wise king, who would bring peace and unity and harmony in his people. So it was sin and selfishness that divided the people, but it would be God bringing his son through righteousness, through justice, with love, and with holiness that would bring the people together. And so what we've seen tonight is a failure on the part of Israel to serve God in the way that he wanted them to. But we've also seen here God's faithfulness to his promise. That regardless of Israel's failures, God's promise to David to bring about the Messiah remained true and steadfast. And we have seen that promise fulfilled today in Jesus Christ. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, you have not submitted to this king, this is a time for you to do so. Maybe you recognize that you too are in sin, that you have not been following God. Maybe you've been following other gods like Jeroboam or Rehoboam. You've set up an idol of self, or an idol of money, or an idol of whatever it is that you put in front of God, and you need to take that away. God offers you mercy and grace through Jesus the King. And if you will submit to him, he will forgive you and he will become your Lord. And he'll grant you an eternal home in heaven with him one day. Do you want to experience that blessing tonight? Do you want to make that commitment this evening? I want to encourage you through this song. And if you are a Christian, perhaps you need the prayers of the saints here. We're going to encourage you. We're going to help you whatever need you have as we stand and as we sing. Desire.